Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, August 17th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. America has heard the sounds of white supremacist demonstrators over the weekend in Charlottesville. What you just heard is the sound of counter-demonstrators clashing with those white supremacists in Virginia. Now, many of them would call themselves anti-fascists or Antifa. It's a loosely organized, wide amalgamation of leftist activists whose express purpose is to stand up to white supremacy, Nazism, and white nationalism. President Trump now famously said there were bad people on both sides of those Charlottesville protests, the ones that led to dozens of injuries and a 32-year-old woman named Heather Heyer to die when a white supremacist allegedly used his car as a weapon. Peter Beinart is contributing editor at The Atlantic. He's reported extensively on Antifa for September's issue of the magazine, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the key features of Antifa protesters, their aims, their tactics?
Antifa is a movement which has its roots in the early 20th century in anti-fascists who fought fascists in the 20s and 30s in Germany, Italy, and Spain. It kind of revived in the 80s and 90s as part of the punk music scene when neo-Nazis were infiltrating punk music. The key thing which makes Antifa activists different than other members of the left is, as a largely anarchist movement, they don't believe in political action through the state, which is they're not trying to elect candidates. They're not trying to change legislation. They don't actually want the government to prevent white supremacists from marching. What they want to do is directly confront those white supremacists themselves, partly through nonviolent tactics like trying to expose white supremacists and get them fired from their jobs, and partly with violence by going and trying to disrupt white supremacist rallies.
America may have seen a very popular internet meme now of Richard Spencer, the white supremacist activist, giving an interview on the street in Washington, D.C. He gets punched right in the face. That's Antifa, right?
Right. Now, one of the difficult things about identifying Antifa is that it's a very decentralized movement, and it's also a quite shadowy movement. So Antifa members don't generally identify themselves to the press. They often are masked. So it can be a little bit hard to pin down exactly who is, quote unquote, in Antifa and who isn't. But that was a kind of classic Antifa action.
Now, let's talk about Charlottesville in particular and the pictures and the news reports that a lot of people saw. What did you see in those protests? You know Antifa and their tactics well. What did you see there that were their signatures, their tactics, their strategies?
There was a permit, it seems, that these neo-Nazis and white supremacists got to do their rally. There was a large nonviolent protest in opposition to that. And then it appears that people loosely associated with Antifa probably tried to physically prevent those white supremacists and neo-Nazis from marching. Now, that's not to say that the white supremacists were nonviolent themselves. Obviously, they ended up committing an act of murder, and they came very heavily armed. So this isn't in any way trying to suggest that they weren't responsible for the violence in Charlottesville. But I think it's also quite likely, given what we know about Antifa and given some of the media reports, that Antifa folks went beyond simply nonviolently protesting this march to try to physically prevent it from happening.
Is there a prospective positive part of the agenda? I mean, positive in terms of something that they're for. I mean, anti is in the name, anti-fascist, right? Antifa. Are they there just to confront, prevent, and occasionally assault Nazis and white supremacists, or is there something else to the agenda?
The short-term agenda, I think, Antifa folks would say, is to protect vulnerable people from white supremacists, both from the physical threat of white supremacists, which we've seen not only in Charlottesville but also the murders earlier this year in Portland. But also, I think Antifa folks would probably argue that there's a harm that's done simply by allowing white supremacists to spew their kind of awful hatred against vulnerable minorities. In terms of a longer-term agenda, it's a little shadowy because anarchism would strike most people as a rather remote goal as a political agenda, right? I mean, it's the kind of dismantling of the centralized state. What does that even really actually mean? So it's hard, for me at least, to kind of see where the positive agenda is, given that the positive agenda is so revolutionary and so would mean something so radically different than anything we've known in terms of governing organization in American history.
What about the press? There were at least two journalists in Charlottesville that I've seen who were assaulted by Antifa protesters. One camera person, another reporter who said they were punched in the face for recording Antifa protesters.
For me, it suggests part of the danger here and why I, as a liberal, think liberals, while rejecting the false equivalence that Donald Trump suggested between Antifa and white supremacists, need to recognize that Antifa is a problem in its own right. It's a genuinely illiberal movement in my view, and I think it's illiberal because Antifa folks essentially give themselves the right to determine who has the right to assemble and speak. And even though no one elected them, even though they have no legal authority to do that, and even the right to use violence. And I think that's a dangerous kind of power. And it may not seem as bad when it's directed at people as vile as neo-Nazis and white supremacists. But who knows when Antifa folks are going to take it upon themselves to decide that other people have views that are too objectionable to be able to speak, or journalists who are too objectionable somehow to be able to do their jobs. That seems to me dangerous. And as I wrote in my Atlantic piece, there's some evidence from Portland in particular, where Antifa is pretty strong, that we're heading in that direction.
Peter Bonner, let's talk about equivalency here. Bids for equivalency are pretty common in politics. Sometimes call it whataboutism. No one expects to see it when one side is composed of white supremacists and Nazi sympathizers chanting anti-Semitic slogans. But the president drew an equivalence between both sides. Having studied Antifa groups, how do you interpret that?
I'm a critic of Antifa, but I don't think there's any equivalence for several reasons. First of all, while Antifa does commit acts of violence, the violence is much smaller in scale than the violence we've seen from the far right. If you look at studies of political murders over the last 10 years in the United States, for instance, the Anti-Defamation League has such a study, you find that a very high percentage of those politically motivated murders are committed by the white supremacist right, a smaller percentage by jihadi terrorists, and a tiny percentage by the far left. So that's one difference. A second difference is that even if Antifa's ideology were as abhorrent as the quote-unquote alt-right, it doesn't have nearly the power. I mean, the alt-right really has a line to the White House, to the Trump administration in a variety of ways, including Steve Bannon. Antifa has nothing of the equivalent. They don't have any political power like that. And thirdly, their ideology is not equally obnoxious. I'm not an anarchist. I have my problems with anarchism, but it's not an ideology like white supremacism that sees certain racial or religious groups as inferior.
Peter Beinart's been spending time with Antifa protesters. He writes about them in The Atlantic. Peter, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We want to hear from you about this. What do you think about Antifa protesters? What do you think about their tactics and their strategies? You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can reach us on the website or on our Facebook page. And there's more fallout now for the White House after Charlottesville, and in this case, the president's reaction to it. This week, several CEOs quit two economic advisory councils. And then on Wednesday, the president announced on Twitter that he was disbanding those councils altogether. Kenneth Frazier, the CEO of the pharmaceutical company Merck, was the first of nine executives to resign from a manufacturing council in response to the president's handling of the violence in Charlottesville. Three executives on another business council had already resigned over the president's position on the Paris Climate Accords and his so-called Muslim travel ban. And members had reportedly organized a conference call to talk about disbanding the group right around the time the president announced he was already ending it. Sheila Kolhatkar is staff writer for The New Yorker and joins me now. Welcome, Sheila.
Hi.
This is the kind of access and clout that corporations usually spend a lot of energy and a great deal of money with lobbyists and others to get to. So can we discern where the line was here that made so many of them back away to say, hey, this isn't in our business interests to stay next to the president of the United States?
Well, it's true that I think that they tend to make decisions oftentimes based on a cost and benefit analysis. And certainly in this case, the cost started to outweigh the benefits. Now, I think even the CEOs who were not personally aligned with President Trump's philosophy or some of his ideas, such as on immigration, as you mentioned, you know, I think they really did want the possibility of influencing his policy ideas. And frankly, I think the business community expected the Trump administration would be giving them a lot of gifts, business-friendly policies, lower corporate taxes, reduced regulation, loosening of environmental laws. And some of those things have been happening behind the scenes. But on a big picture level, the major policy promises do not seem to be coming together. Tax reform was going to be the next one, but all of this turmoil is undermining all of that. And I think they finally realized that it was going to hurt them to stick around.
So does this mean that if the legislative agenda from the White House, the pro-business agenda, were going more smoothly, even with the public condemnation of how the president handled Charlottesville, that a lot of these CEOs might have stuck it out?
I think it might have helped influence their decision. I think it would have been a harder decision for some of them. I think also the fact that these councils sort of dissolved is a sign that perhaps they weren't doing much anyway. My sense is that some of these business leaders didn't feel like they were actually having a lot of influence, and that this whole thing was a kind of window dressing for Trump to kind of parade them around and have photo ops. But I think that many of them were not seeing results. So in the end, why should they, you know, take the hit for being associated with these sort of toxic ideas that he's brought forth, when they're not really getting anything out of it?
Still, Sheila Kolhatkar, it should be noted, tax reform is going to be difficult, but they do have a shot at it. It's worth $1 trillion. And a lot of these companies are getting a great deal of what they like from this administration. Regulations are going out the window left and right. It's not like it's a bad time for them.
That's absolutely correct. And I think that is reflected in the stock market. The stock market has continued to go up for the most part, in spite of all sorts of, you know, frightening signs on the horizon, including these recent, you know, sort of shaking relationships with North Korea. And that's a reflection of optimism about corporate earnings. And it's true that while everyone has been very focused on Trump and his Twitter feed, behind the scenes, there are groups of people within the White House who are making big changes that are going to affect business. One of the biggest ones is the deregulation sort of push that's going on. I mean, all of that is happening quietly while everyone is distracted by the sort of circus that's playing out.
Lots of optimism from the corporate world about their prospects, even as they back away from photo ops with the president on his economic councils. Sheila Kolhatkar, staff writer for The New Yorker, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been asking you, if you're a business owner, have you ever walked away from a deal in order to stand up for a principle you believe in?
I'm an independent contractor here in Vermont, and multiple times I have fired or refused to work with subcontractors being racist, sexist, or homophobic on site.
I am an artist. When I sell a painting, I have the buyer sign an agreement that states the copyright of the work is retained by me. I have refused to sell works 2 times. When the buyer refused to sign this.
Your calls at 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. In 2017, there have been more than 2,400 migrant deaths in the Mediterranean Sea, many of them fleeing war and poverty in the Middle East and Africa and trying to reach Italy or Greece or Spain. But there's another extremely dangerous migration route that receives a lot less attention. Nearly 340,000 migrants and refugees have landed on the coast of Yemen since 2010, after traveling across the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden from countries in the Horn of Africa, places like Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. Accidental deaths are common, just like in the Mediterranean smuggling routes, but now aid organizations are documenting the disposal of migrants pushed overboard into rough seas by smugglers who were fearful of getting caught by authorities. William Lacey Swing is Director General of the International Organization for Migration.
There were two very tragic incidents. The first one took place on the 9th of August. There were 120 migrants who were forced from a boat in the Red Sea between Yemen and Djibouti, more or less, in that area. We know that virtually none of them were able to swim. We provided urgent medical care as well as food and water to 27 of the survivors. The next day, the 10th of August, there was another ship with 160 migrants on board, also forced into the sea off the coast of Yemen's Shabwa governorate. We found six bodies on the beach. We found another four later, and on the 12th of August, another two. So the sum total of all of those that we know of, the 280 people forced into Yemen's rough seas, 226 people survived, 41 confirmed dead, and 12 still missing. So the total number of presumed dead is about 53. Now, this is the Red Sea is very rough, and every time they make a crossing, they're taking a big risk, but particularly when they put their lives into the hands of smugglers, whom we've come to call the travel agents of death. The same thing is happening, of course, in the central Mediterranean between Libya and primarily Italy.
Is this simply an effort from smugglers to avoid authorities? They see patrol boats and they cast people overboard to avoid getting caught?
That's exactly right. They have been pushing migrants out of the boats for a long time, fearing that the security forces might catch them. And if their cargo is gone, then they cannot be accosted, in effect. That's what it is. And these people are also paying very large sums of money. We have anything from $500 up to several thousand. We don't know how much they're all paying, but we know that smugglers are making much more money than is realized. It's third only to running drugs and guns, frankly, and even more inhumane.
Well, we've been talking a lot, William Lacy Swing, on this program about the smuggling networks across the Mediterranean. You mentioned them from Libya and other places as migrants from Africa try to get to Europe. This is off the Horn of Africa. Can you describe how these networks operate and why do people from Ethiopia or Eritrea or Somalia want to go to Yemen?
It's a series of motivations. One, of course, is they're all fleeing abject poverty. As you know, there's a drought in several of these countries where actually a famine has been declared in four or five countries by the Secretary General. Some of them are fleeing for other reasons. Basically, they're economic migrants looking for work. They're not going to Yemen. They're not heading to Yemen. They're heading to the Gulf countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. About 5 years ago, I went to Obok in Djibouti to establish a migrant reception center to try to counsel them about the risk and dangers of smuggling. But if you cannot then at the same time offer them a job, they simply continue their journey. And then for years and years now, we end up flying most of them back home out of Yemen because they never can get into any of the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia.
What are these smuggling networks like and what kind of risks are they willing to take for the lucrative trade that you're describing?
Well, it is exactly that, a lucrative trade. They are interlinked with the international criminal networks, the ones running drugs and guns, as I mentioned. There's three problems here. One is the preventive measures we can take, information campaigns, trying to spread the word. Secondly is trying to protect the victims. And we've protected and sent home thousands and thousands of victims of trafficking and smuggling. But the weak spot in all of this, frankly, is the prosecution. We end up catching the small minnows, but never the big fish. And that, I think, is the biggest thing, cracking into that network. And frankly, trying to break up their business model, which depends on poor people fleeing, looking for work, who end up either in the sea or in a detention center somewhere where they can then scalp them for more money from home.
Do you feel like once it gets to the point that patrol boats from a local government, whether it's Yemen or Saudi Arabia or even Americans, apprehend these smuggling boats on the high seas, that by then it's too late, that interdiction needs to happen much earlier?
I mean, all of these efforts can help. In Libya, I just came back from Libya last week, and we are trying there on the ground to try to offer them alternatives to taking the risky trip across the Mediterranean. For example, if they if we believe they have a sound case for 1951 refugee protection, we can turn them over to our traditional partner, UNHCR. If they're weary from the journey or think they've made a mistake, we can take them home voluntarily. I put 134 Guinea-Conakry migrants on an IOM plane in Tripoli last week, 10 days ago, and we provide them some compensation, some money, so they can get life started again and return to their home with dignity. And that decreases the likelihood they'll try the journey again irregularly.
I wonder if the world hasn't sort of missed what's going on in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea and the area around Yemen and the Horn of Africa that you're describing.
I think it very much is a story that needs to be told. It is virtually an untold tale right now. I mean, we can document for you, and we have documented through our Missing Migrants Project, 3,700 who died in 2015. Last year, it was more than 5,000 just in the Mediterranean. And this year, we're already at about 2,400 deaths, even though the number of arrivals in Europe has gone down by about a third. The deaths remain very high, which means that the smugglers are very much still very active.
William Lacey Swing, thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
William Lacey Swing is Director General of the International Organization for Migration. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We turn now to Sierra Leone, where deadly mudslides have claimed the lives of hundreds of people. Mass flooding swept through one of the poorest areas outside the capital city of Freetown earlier this week, where a hillside collapsed, trapping people and burying them in the mud and under their destroyed homes. At least 400 bodies have been recovered so far, many of them children. And the number of dead is expected to rise dramatically as rescue efforts continue. Morgues are overwhelmed, meanwhile, leading to mass burials. The president has declared a week of national mourning, and thousands who did survive have lost their homes. Now, flooding is common in Freetown, but Sierra Leone hasn't seen a natural disaster on this scale in recent memory. As the population has exploded in Freetown, unregulated construction of informal settlements has increased on hilly terrain, and many experts say poor infrastructure and excessive deforestation set the stage for this week's tragedy. Jamie Yaya Berry joins me now from Dakar, Senegal. He's a research assistant for the West and Central Africa bureaus of our partner, The New York Times, and he's a native of Sierra Leone. He's been watching this tragedy unfold. Jamie, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First, what are the latest reports that you're hearing from Freetown and the conditions there?
The latest for now is today, they're doing burials of the body that has been recovered so far. Yesterday, the families were invited at the hospital to identify some of the missing family members. And I spoke to a family that lost about 9 people, and they identified 5 of those people at the hospital. There were thousands that turned up at the hospital, so it was chaos. And today, they're doing a final burial of all of the bodies that have been recovered so far.
So I understood, Jamie, that flooding is very common in Freetown at this time of year. But what are some of the conditions that led not only to the severe flooding, but then for an entire hillside to fall away in the way that it did with so many houses on it?
I think these are problems that have been going on for years, and this was going to happen, but nobody knew when. Over the years after the war, there was a rush into the capital in Freetown, and everybody wanted to live in the city. People wanted to have houses in the city. And Freetown is made up of mountains and hills, and so there, everybody was just building on top of the mountains. The higher they go, they thought the more powerful you are. So the elites were in the political class were building houses right on top of the mountains, and there were warnings from environmental organizations that this is going to happen. It's going to create a problem in the next coming years.
Sierra Leone is also a country that has just come through a terrible Ebola epidemic, and now this. What's the attitude of people that you're talking to or friends or family around Freetown now?
In Sierra Leone, we have a culture of, you know, blaming God for whatever that happens, and people will say, oh, this was meant to be, this is God's will. Even if those people that died, even if they were living in the U.S. or wherever, they will still come and die in this place.
That might make it very difficult for the government to feel like the population wants this to be avoided next time.
We've already destroyed the environment, and we've destroyed the rainforest. We've cut down the trees. We've bring down the mountains. And so we've destroyed the environment, and now the environment is fighting back. So the more we fail to protect the environment, the more the environment will fight back. So now the government is blaming the citizen and saying they were not supposed to be there. And the citizens are saying the government was supposed to protect them. So even if they were not supposed to be there, the government should have given them notice to leave. And one interesting thing that happened just 2 days after the mudslide, the deputy minister of lands went there and they started marking houses and telling people to leave. It's the raining season. The rains are still coming. You can't just go and say, I give you a week to leave. Where will they go? They don't have anywhere to go. I think the government should have provided a way to relocate the remaining people. This is going to happen again, and this will continue to happen as long as we don't protect the environment.
Devastating mudslides in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Jamie Yaya Berry with our partner, The New York Times, in Central and West Africa. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've reported on this show on President Rodrigo Duterte's indiscriminate and violent drug war in the Philippines. And now there are signs that Duterte's brand of extrajudicial killings might be spreading to other countries. In neighboring Indonesia, President Joko Widodo, also known as Jokowi, issued a similar blunt order last month to his national police. Gun them down, he said. Give them no mercy. Now, the numbers seem to back up this tough talk. Amnesty International has reported that so far this year, there have been 60 police killings. That's a sharp rise from the 18 reported during all of 2017. So what does this mean for the region? Joining me now is Phelim Kine. He's deputy director of the Asia Division for Human Rights Watch, where he supervises work on the Philippines, Indonesia, and Afghanistan. Phelim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So what's going on here in Indonesia? Is President Jokowi taking a cue from Duterte? Is this sort of get tough on drugs emulation?
I think what we're seeing is it's a real danger of what I'm calling the Duterte contagion effect, in the sense that politicians are looking at how Duterte has conducted this lawless slaughter of mostly urban slum dwellers that has been essentially a political plus. It's won him a lot of favor amongst the middle class, and it's essentially offering a very simple, brutal solution to a very complex problem, that of illegal drugs. And our concern is that Jokowi is seeking to emulate that in terms of what we're seeing of his, the statements he's made, and in the rising death toll in Indonesia from police killing drug suspects.
Indonesia is already a place that's known for very strict drug laws. Is there a perception among the population that this kind of vigilantism or draconian crackdown is something that'll benefit the country?
Yeah. President Jokowi himself has described Indonesia as being in the throes of a drug emergency. And that's something that isn't borne out by the statistics when you take a look at how Indonesians use, consume, abuse drugs. And he's sort of walked the walk on that by making the execution of convicted drug traffickers a top priority.
Okay, execution of drug traffickers is a judicial situation. They get convicted. He executes them, people like that. We're talking about killings that seem to be in the streets. He says gun them down.
What we know from analysis by a University of Melbourne academic based on media reports is that at least 49 suspected drug traffickers have been gunned down from in the first 6 months of this year. Now, you look at the numbers. That in 2015, only 10 drug traffickers were shot down. Last year, it was 14. So there has been a more than threefold jump in killings by police of suspected drug traffickers since Jokowi and senior police officials have publicly come out in support of a Duterte-style tough-on-crime approach.
Now, Duterte in the Philippines was widely perceived as getting a green light from the United States. There were transcripts of calls between him and President Trump where Trump praised his crackdown in a way. Is Jokowi taking a cue here? Does it matter what the United States thinks?
You know, it was incredibly damaging that, you know, 2 weeks ago, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was in an ASEAN meeting in Manila and didn't raise the issue of the thousands of Filipinos who have been gunned down. And we talk about thousands. We're talking about estimates of at least 7,000 up to 12,000 people in the last 13 years. months have been killed. And that's incredibly damaging. It sends the message to Asian regional states that, you know, that the United States has priorities in the region, but rule of law and protection of citizens from extrajudicial killings is not one of them.
Do we have reason to believe that Jokowi would respond to an American condemnation if the Secretary of State were to say, don't let this spread to Indonesia? Would they comply?
Well, messaging is incredibly important. So obviously, yeah, making those statements is important symbolically. But the other thing is that, you know, Indonesia has a very close relationship to the United States in terms of foreign aid, bilateral investment in Indonesia, and support for the security forces, including the Indonesian National Police. So, you know, the U.S. government could make it clear that U.S. support for the Indonesian police might come to an end if these types of killings continue and rise at the rate that they have been.
Still, it should be said, Phelim Khan, that apparently Jokowi in Indonesia doesn't see a political downside to what he's doing.
There can be political capital made from these types of brutal, unlawful targeting of very marginalized, vulnerable populations, particularly the urban poor. This is what we've seen in the Philippines. I mean, Duterte calls this a war on drugs in the Philippines. It's actually a war on the poor when you look at the profile of the victims.
Phelim Khan with Human Rights Watch, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And now to an immigration case that might not be quite what some people expect from the Trump administration and its immigration policy. The Department of Labor under President Trump is going after an Arizona company for poor conditions and for mistreating migrant workers. A judge awarded a temporary injunction against G Farms in El Mirage, Arizona. It's the first of its kind. Officials discovered that guest laborers picking onions and watermelons were having their pay withheld, and that workers were being forced to live out of converted school buses in conditions one official described as a horror show. Now, this has all cast renewed light on the state of migrant laborers here in the United States. There were just over 134,000 H-2A visas given out in 2016, allowing foreign workers to enter the U.S. on a seasonal basis and to help fill a shortage of agriculture jobs on farms across America. Philip Martin is here. He's professor of agriculture and resource economics at UC Davis. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Philip Martin, do the abuses alleged at G Farms sound familiar? Is this the kind of thing that guest workers face that maybe doesn't usually wind up in the headlines or in a lawsuit?
Well, the G Farms case is probably a bit unusual because the federal government moved aggressively and sought a federal injunction so that if the farm were to once again violate the housing rules or the wage rules, it would be defying a federal court order rather than going through the normal procedure, which would be a Department of Labor administrative proceeding. So the investigators in Arizona must have found conditions that were more severe than they usually encounter when they're inspecting farms that employ H-2A guest workers.
Do most farms that employ workers with those visas get inspected?
Well, the way the process works is it's a three-stage procedure. First, farmers have to try and fail to recruit U.S. workers. Second, they have to provide the foreign guest workers, as well as any out-of-area U.S. workers, with free and approved housing. And third, they have to pay an adverse effect wage rate, which is a wage rate higher than the federal or state minimum wage. So the housing at G Farms had been inspected before the workers arrived. For some reason, the inspected housing was not available when the workers arrived, and instead the employer put them, according to the employer, temporarily into school buses, which was not approved.
Why is this lawsuit significant? We mentioned it's the first of its kind. Does it signal more actions coming from the federal government?
Traditionally, what happens is when there are violations of the H-2A regulations, the farmer wants the work to get done. The workers want to earn the wages. So usually the practice has been to allow the work to continue, but to insist that the violations be corrected. And if they're not corrected, the Department of Labor can levy fines. So the idea of going to an injunction, that could be a new and tougher enforcement tactic. We just don't know yet.
Now, some people have expressed some surprise here, Professor Martin, that the Trump administration, which has had a very tough stance on immigration and at times anti-immigrant rhetoric, has chosen an enforcement here alleging abuse against guest workers. Is that surprising to you? And is there a strategy here?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the Trump administration plans are. I do know that the H-2A program has doubled in size over the last 10 years. And it is continuing to increase. And we will have to wait and see if this particular enforcement action is the first of many or a one-time event.
Do you have any sense of what it could mean? I realize I'm asking you to speculate. What could it mean if there's more enforcement of H-2As and conditions at farms and sites around the country where guest workers are employed?
The H-2A program is expanding because there has been a sharp slowdown in the influx of new unauthorized Mexicans who are willing to go and work just about anywhere in U.S. agriculture or in non-farm jobs. The expenses associated with H-2A workers could be higher, especially for those farmers who decide they're going to use guest workers and then try to cheat on the side, by not having adequate housing as they promised, or by not paying that adverse effect wage rate as they promised to do. The higher cost associated with H-2A could slow the expansion, which is now underway.
So clearly, Professor Martin, there's a lot of demand for the inexpensive labor that still drives a lot of agriculture in this country. I assume that farmers are clamoring to Congress for some help here. What's likely to happen?
Hard to know. What farmers have been asking for two decades is an alternative to the H-2A program that eliminates the need to try to recruit U.S. workers, that eliminates the requirement to provide housing, and that reduces that adverse effect wage rate back toward the minimum wage.
So it's interesting then what appears on its face to be enforcement that could protect the interests or the living conditions of migrant workers may in fact go the opposite way in spurring an alternative program to H-2As that just makes it easier and cheaper and leaner for farmers to do business without having to go through a lot of steps.
Tighter enforcement should raise the cost of H-2As, which should speed up mechanization. On the other hand, tighter enforcement that then leads to another or a different guest worker program with fewer regulations could wind up increasing the use of foreign guest workers.
A lot of different dynamics and different pressures here as the Department of Labor gets an injunction against one farm in Arizona for its treatment of guest workers. Philip Martin, Professor of Agriculture and Resource Economics at UC Davis. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, the lead singer of Spoon, Britt Daniel, muses on what it means to find commercial success when you've been considered an indie band for more than 20 years.
The fact that our music gets used on TV shows,
that's cool.
It's gravy, you know? The album is what it's all about to us, but you have to be looking at this as somewhat of a business. If The Simpsons wants to use one of our songs, I'm all for it.
Can you believe it?
All the music you've been hearing throughout the show today comes from Spoon. That's thanks to our Spoon fans in the Takeaway Control Room. Britt Daniel is coming up next here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.
This is Todd Zwillick, and here on The Takeaway, we're asking you to free your mind.
There is no spoon.
There is no spoon?
All right, actually, we just wanted an excuse to play that clip. In fact, there is a very big spoon on the show today, even if it still calls itself indie.
Solid my mind, all of the time you must be.
Yes, as part of our drive to figure out terms like indie rock and what it actually means, we got Britt Daniel, guitarist and lead singer for Spoon, to come in and hang out with us for a while. Spoon's latest album is Hot Thoughts. It was released last spring and was produced right after the deaths of David Bowie and Prince. I sat down with Britt Daniel to talk about the group's evolution, its steady representation in pop and commercial culture, and more.
We've always had elements of R&B. We've always leaned on that, or at least maybe after the first record or two. But yeah, I think it's something about it is making people feel a little more like dancing with this one. If a band has been around for a while, then what I like is to see them thinking about it. Even the Ramones got a little different as they went along.
You know? Little.
They got a little bit more metal. Maybe it's a risk that bands are taking when they do that, but I think that on the other side of it, you risk being very boring. To me, that's the weightier risk.
Well, let's take a listen to a track here, Can I Sit Next to You? I've been down so long. I've been working on a plan, yeah. It's just that I've been down so long. I gotta give me my work. Can I sit next to you? You sit next to me, oh. They told me that you're a big Prince fan, which is something I didn't know. Yeah. It seems like it's coming through there a little bit in Purple.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, yeah, I love a lifelong Prince fanatic. Somebody left a copy of 1999 at my house on cassette when I was 11 years old. That was it. Always been a fan since.
You know, so many of us are that same way, lifelong Prince fanatics. But ever since he left the earth, I mean, you've seen this influence artists like you. There are many others who we've talked to on this show. Everybody is like bleeding Prince now. It's all coming out because he's not around anymore, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that for sure where you know, the last time I saw Prince was 2013. He played a corporate show during South by Southwest, and I was there. But if I would have known it was the last time I was going to see him, I would have made my way to the front, you know. At the time, I thought, well, I'll get to see Prince again next year.
Yeah.
And the year after that. But yeah, once someone's gone, then you really feel it.
I mean, is there a part of you as an artist who loved him so much? Do you think that's still bringing that influence out because Prince isn't around anymore? Obviously, you're thinking about him because he's gone.
Yeah, he died when we were making this record. Bowie died right before we started recording, and then Prince was in the thick of recording. And so I went through this obsessive phase, and I went and I found a bunch of there was somebody who was selling a lot of 160 CDRs of Prince on eBay, which I bought, which ended up being all I listened to all last summer, and it was some live stuff, but a lot of vault stuff from the classic era, you know, 80 through 87 or so. Not sure what he would have thought of that. But the fact that I could drive to the recording studio and put on a Prince song from 1981 that I had never heard before, I mean, that's got to be inspiring, right?
Yeah. Spoon also has this remarkable commercial success. I mean, your music is all over pop culture. It's on The Simpsons, it's in Scrubs, How I Met Your Mother. Really all over the place. Do you enjoy that part of your career, or is that sort of necessary because it doesn't last forever and you want to make sure you make a living?
The fact that our music gets used on TV shows, that's cool. It's gravy, you know? The album is what it's all about to us, but you have to be looking at this as somewhat of a business. If The Simpsons wants to use one of our songs, I'm all for it.
Lisa, make them stop. I'm sorry, but as a filmmaker, I have to face the truth. I turned my camera on. I cut
my fingers on the way. But at the same time, you know, you guys are called indie rock, thought of as an indie band. You're back on Matador, an indie label. But there's all these TV shows, Dr. Pepper commercials that are using your music, which is fine. But the label, I mean, does indie mean anything anymore in that sense? Or is it just another marketing label at this point for labels?
It seems like if you're a band that has guitars, unless you're Maroon 5, you're indie. I don't know. What does it mean to you, indie? Indie rock? I know what indie as a consumer term means, you know, but I never really understood the definition. I understand what it means to be a rock band on an independent label. That I get. But when they talk about it as a genre, as a sound, then that has confused me.
So, Britt Daniel, you're back home in Austin now. What's next for the band? You going back out on the road?
Yeah, we're going out tomorrow. I've been home for 3 days. And it truly is the most immediately rewarding part of being in a band. You know, doing gigs is, that's fun. You know, being on tour is fun. I'm lucky that I feel that way because I don't think everybody does, but it's a blast for me.
Yeah, and you're lucky that you guys are a live band, that you can actually do it.
That's true. Most important thing is the records, but most immediately, you know, on a day-to-day basis, if I'm going out and doing shows, that's going to be a fun day.
I mean, I don't even know if this is a fair question, and you'll shoot it down if it isn't, but if you're getting into what we started off calling a dancier, more electronic style away from the acoustic style that your fans are used to, you take that on stage into the live show, does it translate to the stage? Does it translate live? Can you guys do it?
Yeah, no, I think it really has been translating. I think we're doing the best shows we've ever done. You got to go see it yourself, but I'm proud of it. I don't think there's any question that what we're doing is really good right now.
Britt Daniel of Spoon, thanks so much.
Nice to chat with you.
Spoon's new album is Hot Thoughts. The band is on tour right now. And finally today, all this week, we've been following reaction to the events in Charlottesville and President Trump's responses. Now more commentary from the president on the matter. He was on Twitter to say more about the removal of Confederate monuments around the country. The president said, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson. Who's next? Washington? Jefferson? So foolish. Also, the beauty that is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks will be greatly missed and never able to be comparably replaced." That's the latest from President Trump there, weighing in on what he sees as the irreplaceable beauty of Confederate monuments. Now, the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, stood by Trump on this. He said in an interview yesterday, and this is a quote, "Just give me more. Tear down more statues. Say the revolution is coming. I can't get enough of it." That's Steve Bannon saying that he thinks that this is a great political place for the president and for the White House to be. And we'll see if the president continues to follow Steve Bannon's advice here. Give us your take at 8778MYTAKE or on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can always visit the website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. When the mood of the era is gone, everybody fading, even my mom, and the words get stuck on the tip of my tongue.
PRI, Public Radio International.